More vaccination sites come to the First Coast as the city tackles food deserts in some neighborhoods, and a groundbreaking for Lift Every Voice and Sing Park. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later this Black History Month, we spotlight another Black-owned business. This one is expanding around the First Coast. The delicious story of Mr. Potato Spread. That's right. But first, it's Friday. And here to discuss yet another busy week in the news, we welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union. Hi, Dan. Actually, we don't have Dan yet. Let's go to Tim Gibbons of the Jacksonville Business Journal. Hi, Tim. Okay, it's one of those mornings. Let's see if we have journalist Claire Goforth on the line and via Airlink as well. Hey, Claire, good morning to you.
Good morning.
WJCT contributor Charles Griggs also with us. Hi, Charles.
I'm here, Melissa. Good morning.
Excellent. We'll try to connect the rest of our panel in just a moment. We are now going to Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Good morning. And let's see, maybe we'll get lucky and get our fourth member of the panel connected. It's, you know, people, we are just as stressed out and tired as everybody else around town. Tim Gibbons, editor at the Jacksonville Business Journal. Hi, Tim. Are you there? Okay. We'll get Tim in a minute. And all of you listening out there, you can add your voice to the conversation. Give us a call as we talk about the top stories of the week. It's 549-2937, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page, as always, is open. Lots of news to discuss. We'll go to your calls, emails, and tweets in just a bit. But let's begin with some good news. We can all use that right now. More vaccination sites are opening across the region. Next week, a new federally run site will open up at the Gateway Town Center. There will be a vaccination site at Edward Waters College. Shots are now available in 25 public supermarkets and 18 Walmarts in Duval County alone. Southeast Grocers, the parent company of Winn-Dixie and Harvey stores, also announced Thursday it will open two new vaccine sites in Duval County. That brings the company's total to 7 in our area. They will have opportunities in Nassau and St. John's County as well to receive your COVID vaccine. All this as the State Health Department reports active cases of COVID and the death toll continues to rise around Florida. But nearly 3 million Floridians have received at least one dose of vaccine so far. Mayor Curry has extended the mask mandate through March. And we hope to hear more about the new Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is undergoing FDA review and should soon be available. We'll go to your calls at 549-2937 in a few minutes. But Charles Griggs, let's begin with you. New vaccination opportunities both at Gateway Town Center and at Edward Waters College. We saw Governor Ron DeSantis come to EWC this week to announce this. And he seemed to be, in part at least, responding to criticism that the vaccines have been more easily available in white and upper class areas or more affluent areas of Florida. The governor coming to Duval to say that he's working to expand access to everyone. How did that sit with you as you listened to the governor's comments?
Well, first of all, Melissa, full disclosure, Agape Family Health is one of my clients. So I was attending the event yesterday.
Yeah, and they were distributing, right.
Yeah, they were distributing. This is good news to the entire community, not only because vaccine has been readily unavailable in certain areas, but this also works to build trust throughout the community as well, giving communities an opportunity to get in and see for themselves and have more people to be vaccinated provides an opportunity for folks to, you know, to spread the word about the vaccine, so to speak, and build trust around its strength and its safety. So that's good news. The bad news is that we're still dealing with the spread of COVID-19. We're hearing more about these more variants that are coming out. So we're trying to keep pace with this pandemic. And we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're thinking mm-hmm. that if we continue to see these vaccination sites open and access is improved, we will see more people get vaccinated. And as long as people practice those safety precautions, you know, wearing a mask, social distancing and keeping and good hygiene, we can beat this thing. And I think people have an internal clock in their heads. They don't want to go through what they went through last year. They want to be outside and having events and everything by the end of the summer, mm-hmm. Early fall. So if we can kind of continue to stay on this course where we are focused on getting the vaccine to every corner of our communities, that we can get there.
Let's hope so. You know, Claire Goforth, the governor, when he appeared at EWC, he celebrated the state's progress with vaccinating seniors. He pointed out that in Duval County, 55% of seniors have gotten at least one shot. In St. Johns County, it's around 75%. Very high numbers for seniors. By the way, if you don't have a ride to get a vaccine, go to jtafla.com. And access their Rides to Health program. They're giving seniors and other groups free rides to the vaccination site at the Regency Mall, and beginning next week, the new one at the Gateway Town Center. But Claire, you know, as the governor touted the state's success with vaccinating seniors, the Kaiser Foundation released a report this week criticizing Florida, saying that we are the only state in America that hasn't provided a clear roadmap for which groups will be next in line to receive the vaccination. Of course, that's the question so many Floridians have. Frontline workers, healthcare workers, immunocompromised people that are theoretically supposed to get the shot but haven't been able to yet. Everyone wants that information, and the governor has taken criticism for not releasing a more detailed roadmap.
Well, you have to look no further than the comments that he made this week. He said that the age group will be lowered, didn't say to what. He said sometime in the next month and didn't say to when, roughly when. And Florida actually is really middle of the pack when it comes to the percentage of our population that we have vaccinated. According to the New York Times, we're sitting at 13% of our population has received at least one dose. Meanwhile, states like New Mexico and even Alaska have significantly higher rates. In New Mexico, 20% of the population has received one dose. West Virginia, my home state, is doing much better than Florida is. And yet, Governor DeSantis and also Mayor Curry were sort of painting this as a win. It's not a win. A C plus at best in terms of how many people have received a vaccine is a barely, you know, it's just middle of the road. I think that, you know, the governor and the mayor addressing criticisms that it's been easier to get the vaccine in wealthy and white communities, that is very necessary. I mean, we know that poor and minority communities are more at risk of serious health effects and death from the virus, but in Jacksonville, we're still at extremely high risk of spread. You know, more vaccine sites is better. I commend JTA for their program to get people to the vaccine. Transportation is a serious issue in many of those communities. But, I mean, we've got a long way to go, and we're kind of lagging behind, quite frankly, in Florida.
Let us know your thoughts about how Florida's doing with the vaccination rollout. It's our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. Tim Gibbons, what about that? You know, the governor did ignore CDC recommendations from the outset. He has focused mainly on seniors for vaccination, although the CDC recommended that frontline workers be front of the line. Now we're hearing that teachers and law enforcement officers over the age of 50 might be next in line, but we don't know yet for sure.
There is a weird feeling of almost Florida trying to go it alone for no good reason. The governor's not laying out a reason why we should handle things differently than other states are doing, or why we can't lay out a path forward the way other states have. Sometimes it just feels like no, we're going to do it the Florida way just because. Clearly there is a psychological boost in just knowing when your turn is going to be. Everybody wants to get vaccinated. Everybody understands that there are priorities and you know, there will be a queue that people will be in, but where do I stand? Is it going to be months from now? Is it going to be a year from now? Having people have more information just gives more peace of mind.
Right. Dan Scanlon, information is the commodity everybody is desperately seeking in this pandemic. Here's another data point. The Conservative Political Action Conference is happening in Orlando. Former President Trump expected to speak. Governor DeSantis expected to make an appearance. And what's your reaction to those who've viewed the way Governor DeSantis is dealing with the pandemic through the lens of what's widely believed to be his political ambitions to hopefully run for president himself?
Well, remember weeks ago, our own fire chief, after some of their staff had received the first shots, said, we're all going to have firefighters out at the Prime Osborne Convention Center on Monday to start giving the shots, and then all of that went by the wayside. But I have two new updates that I just got. First of all, Publix just announced that it's now offering COVID vaccinations at all of its in-store Florida pharmacies starting at 7 o'clock today. Appointment
right.
Windows will be available Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays. And the mayor late last night tweeted, I believe we are close to a tipping point in COVID-19 vaccinations. He says supply could be available to all in a month or two. April and May, here we come. So maybe the rest of the folks outside of the seniors, who I would think now a majority of them have gotten their first shot at least, mm-hmm. Maybe the gates will open up.
Let's hope so. That is certainly what we are all hoping for. It's 549-2937. Let us know. Have you received a vaccine yet? How was your experience? Are you hoping to get one? Are you having trouble accessing the vaccine for any reason? What are your questions about locations and opportunities to be vaccinated? Are you continuing to mask up and social distance? 549-2937. Mobeen is on the line. I believe it's Dr. Mobeen Rathore, a pediatric and infectious disease specialist who we book often on this program. Is that you, Dr. Rathore?
Yes, that's me, Melissa. Thank
Hi.
You for having me to make a comment. Thank you, Melissa. I'm going to sort of make a slightly different angle to this discussion. I think it's great that seniors are being immunized, but I think, and healthcare personnel, but we need to sort of make a strategic move to make sure that we can get our teachers and school personnel get immunized so that our kids are able to go to school in safety and without too much anxiety. We need to look at the long term. Our children are suffering by staying at home. It is not healthy for them. They are having lots of challenges. We need to be ready to open the schools as soon as possible, and especially in the fall. So I think it's time that we think about not who votes, but who is important for the future and who is important for our current operation. So I think we need to do that for the sake of our children. It's the future. I mean, there are lots of data, lots of studies suggesting that this, keeping kids not being able to go to school and such, is causing major negative impact on our children.
Absolutely, and I've seen it firsthand with my own kids and their friends, Dr. Rathore. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Rathore, always speaking up for kids and pediatrics. Charles Griggs, you know, we did hear the governor say teachers could be next. Teachers over 50. Certainly, the teachers union in this state has been advocating for all teachers to be vaccinated next. What do you think?
Well, Dr. Rathore, my good friend Dr. Rathore, makes a great observation there. Really, the common sense move would be to make sure that the people who are in charge of our children do get protected. They should be in line to get protected. And I think that just like we've seen a lot of pressure as it relates to access for minority communities and underserved communities, we're now seeing pressure and advocacy for teachers to be next in line to get the vaccine. In some states, of course, they are doing it. Florida just happens to be one of those states that's not doing it at this time. But it would go a long way. I mean, we've got parents. You know, I'm a grandparent, and you know, I send my grandson out to pre-K in the morning, you know, wondering if you know, something he's going to be protected or anything like that, everything like mm-hmm. that. So we've seen the effects. We can set a standard now for, like Dr. Rathore mentioned, for the fall, if we start to get teachers immunized now. And I think the advocacy that we've seen, the advocacy push, has been the drum is being banged louder. And we should see some changes in that here in the coming, hopefully next week, I think, because now since we're seeing more access to vaccines. You know, Melissa, I think that, you know, some of the talk about how the vaccine has been distributed has been back and forth because of how the federal government has been making allotments available as they become available from the pharmaceutical companies, from the distributors.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a difference in how we plan to distribute those allotments on a local level. And the more vaccine that becomes available, we should see that open up to more people and more age groups.
Let's hope so. And the sooner the better. Sarah has been vaccinated. She's in Flagler Beach. Hi, Sarah. Happy Friday.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Friday. I'm off today. So I'm just letting you know I received both of my vaccines. I kind of had to finagle to get them. I work for a large pharmaceutical company as a nurse practitioner. And unfortunately, this company didn't feel like it was important to vaccinate their employees who basically are front line. And, you know, I'm taking care of COVID patients.
Are you?
We're administering tests. And I had to basically, you know, scramble to get the vaccines that were going to be expiring or going to waste, you know, within 24 hours.
Sure.
So I had to kind of, you know, make my own.
So you're caring for COVID workers. Tell us a little bit more about COVID patients. And we're hearing some healthcare workers are actually declining the vaccine. So you wanted the vaccine.
I was on the fence, but then I just said, you know what? I'm not going to overthink it. I'm just going to get it. I've gotten all my other vaccines. Why am I going to make a big deal about this when there's a pandemic going on? Let me just suck it up and do it.
Why were you on the fence, and why are some of your coworkers who are actually working to help COVID patients, you're the most endangered, honestly. Mm-hmm. Why so many of you on the fence?
We're on the fence because of the rapid time frame that, you know, they basically pushed this out. I think it was one of the doctors, I read a research study, said the fastest vaccine they ever got out was measles, mumps, rubella, and that took, you know, 3 years in the 60s. This is a different, you know, day. We've got way more technology. It's a pandemic. There's so many scientists and medical professionals working on it. So that's why we got it out probably within a year, you know. So that was the only hesitancy with it. But, you know, I just had to think realistically and tell myself, well, those are the reason why, you know. So, but it's the time frame. I think that was the biggest thing.
Well, glad to hear you you feel comfortable with your decision, and I want to thank you for that call. That's Sarah in Flagler Beach. Claire Goforth, it's interesting to hear the perspective of a healthcare worker who's treating COVID patients and her experience with this.
It certainly is. It was a bit alarming that she said that her employer didn't feel like they needed to be prioritized.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of inconsistency nationwide, statewide, on who gets the vaccine and when. One group that, you know, in addition to people who work in schools that we're not really talking about very much is transportation workers, people who work for TSA, people who drive buses. You know, these people are seeing large numbers on a daily basis, and they have the potential to not only be infected, but to infect large numbers. And yet they really aren't part of the conversation of people we need to prioritize. Just as the doctor said, and I thought that was a very fine point he made about not only thinking about people who vote at high rates, because we do know the elderly vote at a very high rate, although they're also at extreme risk. So, but to also think about groups who make the most sense. I think that school teachers, many of us would say that school teachers, it's not just for them, but it's for the children who, and their families as well. I mean, children are suffering from mental health issues. Parents, particularly mothers who bear an undue burden in childcare in most homes, are also suffering greatly. I mean, so many women have left the workforce during the pandemic because they have really had no other choice. And, you know, we need to think just beyond the obvious, like we don't want people to spread the virus, catch the virus. We also need to think about the health of the population as a whole on multiple levels.
Dan Scanlon, the big question that everybody's going to have as we move into March is vaccination supply. And I believe one of you just said we could see a huge uptick in supply in the next few weeks. So it could be a very different picture very soon, which is great.
Well, between the federal government and yet another vaccine coming online apparently within the next week or so, that's good news. But here's somebody else who needs vaccines. I was at the Malawi, Washington Youth Foundation earlier this week, and they have about 200 kids in their after-school programs, but they're all 6 feet away. They're all behind plexiglass shields, all the teachers and students wearing masks. If it weren't for the COVID mandates for safety, they'd be able to have more kids in that program, and that would imply other nonprofit programs for kids and adults that right now have to keep social distancing and would be able to have more people if there were more vaccinations out there and it was safer to fill your room, to fill your facility with the numbers it's supposed to have.
Jimmy in Riverside. Hi, Jimmy. Thank you for holding.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Okay, go ahead.
I think that, like, our leadership failed us from the beginning. And the things that we are going through right now is simply due to lack of leadership at the inception of that virus hitting our shores. We had a president that refused to wear a mask, wouldn't listen to the scientists. And so we have all these deaths now, and we still have leadership like that. Governor DeSantis, what is his real plan? Like, I mean, where is he? I mean, it's obvious he's not listening to the science. So, you know, we're going to be like a mouse on a wheel trying to figure this thing out until we get competent leadership.
Thank you, Jimmy. The only caveat I would add to Jimmy's comments, which I think many people share his sentiments, but the only caveat I would add to that, Tim Gibbons, is that states that are seen as blue, run by Democrats, have also struggled with their pandemic response, in particular California. I just want to point that out to note that this is complex. And but that said, certainly it's fair to criticize Florida's response. So, Tim, the politics of the pandemic response, particularly as, by the way, right now as we speak, Governor DeSantis is addressing a very conservative crowd in Orlando at CPAC.
See, I was at the Lift Every Voice in Sing Park groundbreaking the other day, and afterwards, Mayor Curry was taking questions from the media, and we asked him about the mask mandate, and in saying that, yes, he's going to extend it until it is no longer needed, which isn't surprising. That has been the tact he's taken all along, but he said something along the lines of, it aggravates him that the wearing of masks has gotten politicized. And I had to chuckle a little bit because it is, you know, mainly a Republican Party thing that has politicized that. Clearly, there is no state that has gotten COVID totally right. But the idea that the taking personal responsibility and doing social distancing and wearing masks mm-hmm. should not be a political thing. And here locally, frankly, I think the Curry administration has done a good job of not making it a political thing. But for many people, that's how they're approaching it. And it's one of the tragedies of the pandemic that we can't just pull together as a society, as a community, and try to keep everyone safe.
Absolutely right. Steph emails the show from Avondale. She says, I'm a professor of nursing. We are falling through the cracks. I was able to get vaccinated because I still keep a position at a local hospital. But many of my colleagues who are educating future nurses, including in hospital settings, are scrambling to find a place to get vaccinated. And that includes students who are attending clinical training in the hospital but are not a priority for public vaccination. That's Stephanie in Avondale emailing the show. Lots of calls, meanwhile, for our Friday roundtable. Let's get to a few more on vaccinations, and then we'll move on to some other news and notes from the week. Judy in St. Augustine. Hi, Judy. Good morning.
Hi there. I'm here.
Go ahead.
I am a 79-year-old kidney transplant recipient, and I'm frustrated. I feel that no one has addressed our issues as to whether or not it's safe for us to receive the vaccine. I have talked to my GP doctor. I've talked to my transplant doctor. I've made several calls to entities that are doing trials. No trials have been done. I can't discern that any trials have been scheduled. And I feel as though we've all been through the cracks. And of all people with severe immune compromised systems, mm-hmm. I feel we should be at least in the mix.
Have you pre-registered, Judy, since you have a legitimate immune?
I haven't registered because the concern is that I've been told that the vaccine could possibly start a rejection of my body for the kidney. And that is why I can't get the kidney doctor to give me a go-ahead. He doesn't know one way or the other. He said the frustration is there's no trial to discern what's safe and what isn't.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
I feel that that's really unfair to, granted, not a large section of the population, but certainly a significant one. And I'd dearly love to have it. I'm pretty much a prisoner in my home because with all the variants and how transmissible they are, I don't feel it's safe to go anywhere.
Wow. Well, Judy, I'm so sorry you're going through that. And I really appreciate you calling and educating our listeners about the complexities of this. There are lots of factors that go into a person's medical history and how they're going to interact with this vaccination rollout and the problems many people are having.
Yeah. I'm delighted for all the people that have received the vaccine, but I would dearly love to have it. And after going through a kidney transplant, I certainly don't want to jeopardize my kidney.
Sure.
I only have the one, so I feel like I'm stuck.
Thanks, Judy, and sorry to hear. Charles Griggs, you know, Judy's not alone. We've heard a lot of stories like this in recent weeks. This is complicated. This is not one size fits all.
No, it's very complicated, and I definitely sympathize with Judy. And people like her, you know, when they were, remember now, we're just about a year into the response to this pandemic, a real response to this pandemic. We began the response to this pandemic by saying it wasn't really a big deal. It wasn't really going to be a big deal. You know, and then join the chorus of international scientists and doctors trying to find a vaccine. That whole process was expedited. And, you know the pharmaceutical companies, the scientists, research people who are doing the studies were factoring in whatever they could factor in to get the vaccine onto market. That being said, we knew they focused on healthy people and people with comorbidities. Some things got left out of that process. You know, some of the actual information that is necessary to be able to have full confidence in the vaccine across the board for every a medical condition, we just don't know yet. We're just 1 year into this. And so only time is going to tell when more studies have been done, more research has been done of how this vaccine responds to people with very other types of health conditions. You know, we've heard that Pfizer is going back to do more research on a booster shot, you know. So there's still more information to be had about what's going on. Mm-hmm. But right now, the consensus seems to be that the vaccine is safe in order to, stop the spread of COVID-19. So that's where we are right here at this moment.
Let's go to Ingrid, Amelia Island. Hi, Ingrid. Good morning, Ingrid. Go ahead.
Good morning. Yes, I'm calling from Amelia Island. I have a special needs daughter, and so I've served on a rare disease research board for about 15 years. So I really have been diving into this topic. And one thing that hasn't been brought up much, which I think is very positive, exciting news, is about our T-cell reactivity. There's been studies of Peter Doshi in the British Medical Journal did a feature overviewing pre-existing immunity to COVID-19. Pre being back before 2019. In Cell Magazine, there was a study. They tested blood samples from patients from 2015 to 2018, and 50% had an immune response to COVID-19. So with the vaccine being so hard to get, T-cell testing is now actually being done beyond research labs. It's now available clinically. We should be finding out who doesn't have a response and prioritize them for the vaccine instead of trying to get to 100% vaccination or whatever percent is changing, 70% I guess now, for herd immunity, we might actually be a lot closer to that than we think by all these people.
You think 50, 60% of the way rather than 30, 40?
I do. If the low end 30% of those, if you did a broader study, actually already have positivity and 20% who've already gotten natural immunity, yes, I would put us in the 50%.
Okay. Thank you, Ingrid. And let's quickly make mention of the fact that we have heard anecdotally people showing up at the end of the day at, say, the Regency Mall vaccination site and other places without an appointment and just hoping to get lucky, hoping to get a vaccination because they don't want to throw out the unused doses. They want to get them into arms if they can. That's something that's been happening around this, too. Some people have been able to get vaccinated that way. It's our Friday roundtable with Tim Gibbons, Claire Goforth, Dan Scanlon, Charles Griggs, and yours truly as we talk about the biggest stories of the week, 549-2937. Okay, we're going to move on now and get into some other news from the week. As vaccination sites expand around town, the city is also looking to expand transportation service to grocery stores in the Newtown neighborhood. Now, we mentioned that JTA is offering free rides to the Regency Mall site and the new Gateway site for vaccinations. That's their Rides to Health program. More about that at jtafla.com. Well, they're also tackling food deserts. There are many places across massively large Duval County where people have to ride hours on a bus just to buy some fresh produce. Now, as JTA announced this pilot project, Claire Goforth, it's called Door to Store. They launched that actually in February of last year. They're going to continue this, try to expand it. As the city works on food deserts, this Black History Month, I want to make note of some other interesting headlines from the week. One being that students in the Duval County Public Schools rose up, walked out of class, protested and actually forced the school district to change the way it was approaching Black History Month and teaching about local Black history. As that happened, also during Black History Month, at the Jacksonville City Council meeting this week, President Tommy Hazzouri put a member of the public on notice that he will not be allowed to speak to city council at any more meetings if he continues to flash an OK sign that is strongly affiliated with white supremacists. And so, Claire, I know you've written a lot about this issue. I wanted to get your thoughts on, let's begin with the city council issue, the OK sign that someone who wanted to speak before the council flashed, and Hazzouri telling this man, you can't do that in council chambers.
Oh, yes. You had to go there, didn't you?
I did. I'm afraid I did.
I'm afraid you did. And, I'm also an attorney, so this is something that I followed with a lot of interest. There's no denying that the OK symbol has been appropriated by white supremacist groups. And there's a lot of reason to believe that the individual who flashed the OK sign was making reference to that, although they said that they weren't, that it was something they had seen Donald Trump do. Although it's not clear why Donald Trump would do that. Some would say it would be because he was also using it in the way that the white supremacist groups are. I'm sure he would deny that. But here's the problem. It is a sign that means more than one thing. And we're talking about the government telling a citizen that they can't communicate in this particular way in a public forum. The First Amendment is very clear on freedom of speech, and it's very strict when it comes to government regulating speech. There certainly are exceptions to it, but hate speech thus far has not really been an exception to your free where you can regulate speech. If you are going to ban the OK symbol, period, right? Well, there's certainly an argument that someone could just say okay, and they mean it in the normal sense of the word, of the gesture. And now you're putting it to government officials to decide when the okay symbol is okay and when it isn't. You know, white power symbols have no place in our society, but that's a First Amendment case right there.
Yeah. It's a bit of a slippery slope. Dan Scanlon, nobody could give the finger in a city council meeting without facing immediate repercussions. This is slightly more complicated.
Well, it's a very complicated. You're right. It is very complicated. That can simply mean okay, or it can mean any other number of things. President Trump was always known for doing the thumbs up, and that would not be misconstrued. Everybody knows what that means. So it is a slippery slope, but don't forget Tommy Hazzouri has tried to walk across the aisle and work with both sides over the years as mayor, state rep, and school board, and now city council. So maybe his heart's in the right place.
He will be a guest on this program Monday, by the way. We'll talk more about it then. But Charles Griggs, as that happened, how did you react to this rising up by students across the Duval County Public Schools this week? Pushing back against the district about how they're approaching Black History Month and teaching local African-American history.
Using their voice for change is in a proper format, in the proper form, is always good. Even Superintendent Dr. Diana Green commended them on the process. You know, they called it a peaceful protest, and they brought to light information while, you know, the district was still believes that the information they were presenting was important, they still brought to light the importance of how the district approaches Black History Month, and as well as Black history in the schools. So there's nothing wrong with the students using their voices, and as long as they do it in the proper format, in the proper form, which is, looks like the exercise here. It looks like we have advocates and activists in training. And, you know, the good thing, I guess the good news is that this was a mixed group of children, you know, mixed group of kids. Mm-hmm. They weren't all, you know, students of one race. They weren't all Black students. They were students concerned about the curriculum that is being taught in our school system. And traditionally, historically, we've known that that Black History Month has not been a primary focal point when it comes to American history and the way it's been taught in curriculums across our country.
And Tim Gibbons, as all of this happened, as I noted a minute ago, the city is also making, I think, what critics would say is a long overdue effort to address food deserts, which are a product of economic inequality, racial segregation, years of neglect, in underserved neighborhoods in large parts of Duval County. And so that's happening too.
It's one of the things that people mean when they talk about structural racism, when they talk about something being endemic in the society, that the city's failure to replace septic tanks, the lack of sidewalks in certain parts of town, lack of supermarkets in certain parts of town, these are things that are structural and impact the children growing up there and impact the people living there and the people trying to get jobs there and the businesses who want to open in those neighborhoods who look around at the crumbling infrastructure. And those are the type of things that have to be dealt with if we're to have equality, which makes us all better as a city.
Mm-hmm. And okay, speaking of the city, a related story, Dan Scanlon, in your own publication, the Florida Times Union, this week, we saw more coverage of a downtown homeless encampment, a tent city for people who don't have housing in this pandemic. It's gotten bigger and bigger despite attempts from the city to work with agencies like Sulzbacher and others to get people into housing. So if you drive through downtown, you see this tent city with hundreds of people, homeless people. At the same time, we're hearing a lot of high-flown rhetoric about exciting new downtown projects. And but I think it's fair to say there's a lot of cynicism about how those projects are going to be funded and if they're going to move forward. Rhetoric meeting reality is the way the TU put it. So how do you see the city dealing with this in this time of pandemic when we are all rightly concerned about budgets and such? How does the city come out of this and actually execute on the vision for the urban core that the mayor said he's trying to put together? He did assemble a task force of leaders to hold a public forum on that this week, too.
Well, it's interesting where that camp is within walking distance of two of the city's biggest homeless aid agencies. So it's logical, I guess, that they would encamp there. But it's also next to a major corridor, so everyone is looking at it. And with all the development that's been announced this week, not much, if any, has been done in the La Villa area, which is basically next door, other than that beautiful JTA facility. So everything is on the waterfront being announced. Everything is the Metro Park possibilities, the old Jacksonville Landing. And that's wonderful because those are empty lots with nothing on them. But you're right, there's got to be something that's done. There are even fairly new empty facilities next to the Ritz Theater and that whole complex that have never been used when that was rebuilt. And I'm sure the pandemic has further put the kibosh on doing any development of them.
Yeah. And we're seeing Metropolitan Park, Claire Goforth, on the North Bank shrink. It looks like it's going to get smaller. That's what the latest information we're getting out of City Hall is telling us, if it survives at all.
Yeah, that very interesting to know that they did the survey. I believe it was DIA did a survey about what's your favorite downtown park, and Metropolitan Park, the largest, was not on there. And it's lost several acres in the past few years, apparently. What's going on there is pretty clear. They want to use that land. But good luck getting the federal government to agree to that. It's like the clock is winding down in the Curry administration. And he really wants to, as his PAC was named, build something that lasts and probably something that's not just the lawn, or Lenny's lawn, as some people have labeled it, thinking of the landing here and various other open areas in front of the river.
And by the way, they are going to have concerts on that lawn in April, outdoor concerts. So it is being activated that way. I just wanted to throw that in there.
That's great. You know, I've been to great concerts at Met Park. Rockville was awesome there. It has been neglected and ignored. And now they're saying, well, you know, hey, no one's using it, so maybe we should do something else with it. Shad Khan has some great ideas. You know, I mean, we want downtown to thrive, don't we? But when you approach these issues with with no transparency and with what some would refer to as dishonesty in certain cases, it's really hard to convince the public to go along with it. I mean, they've been basically trying to circumvent DIA for the past few years, and that it's supposed to be their job to sort of orchestrate downtown development. The pandemic has made everything more complicated with development issues, but, you know, it just, why can't we just put our resources into Met Park? We need people need more availability to dock a boat along the river. People need more waterfront parks. There's so many great reasons to have them. I mean, they have a cooling effect and recreation that helps the health of the people, and that part of town really needs more parks. You know, this is just going to be another one of those Curry administration things that we look back and say, why weren't you just honest with us in the end?
Well, speaking of parks and downtown development, after years of planning, a groundbreaking was held Wednesday for the future Lift Every Voice and Sing Park in La Villa. That is just west of downtown Jacksonville. I'm going to go around the horn and get everyone's reactions to this. Tim Gibbons, beginning with you, this park, of course, is in honor of Jacksonville's native son, James Weldon Johnson, perhaps the most luminous individual to ever come from Jacksonville. He composed the Black national anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. This park will honor his legacy, and it will also be tied into the Emerald Trail, the sort of green belt that's going to go around the city.
there's so many different things that this park pulls together. There's the belatedly acknowledging Jacksonville's Black history, which Business Journal has argued from an editorial standpoint that you can't truly understand Jacksonville or grow Jacksonville without really engaging with its Black history, that Jacksonville's history is Black history, and the park is part of that. It also has an economic development impact on its own. La Villa, after the raising of it basically in the 90s, has just been this vacant space in downtown.
And not to cut you off, sorry, I just want to get everyone's voice. Charles Griggs, quickly.
Yeah, the more active park spaces we have, the better. The fact that this is a historical site is even more impressive. And an opportunity to provide education to our youth and the community and people from other sides of town and all across the country who come to visit Jacksonville. That's right.
Dan Scanlon.
Well, Lift Every Voice has certainly been recorded in the past few years by some amazing artists. So I think the word has gotten out finally, but maybe or not, they don't let people know that it's Jacksonville-based. But to tie that park into the Emerald Trail and to the Rails to Trails that exist separately but quite nicely around the city, that will be nice. I hope we get to see it literally in the next few years.
And Claire Goforth.
Embracing Jacksonville's Black history could be really a draw point for the tourism industry. Cultural tourism is on the rise, and by really accepting that part of its identity and celebrating it, we could move the needle.
Move the needle forward, and I want to thank you all for being with us to do just that, and have a great weekend, everyone.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
You too.
Do the same.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Claire Goforth, Tim Gibbons, Charles Griggs, and Dan Scanlon all on the show this Friday. More Black history discussion in a moment as we spotlight a local Black-owned business that is actually expanding in this pandemic. Hard to believe, but they're doing it. That's coming up in just a few moments. You're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Here on WJCT News 89.9.
Taxes, the environment, energy, education, healthcare, a state that's gaining nearly 1,000 new residents every day, and the ongoing quest for resources to meet that growing need. These are critical issues that affect everyone in Florida, and they're just some of the issues we follow every week on Capitol Report. It's your direct connection to what's going on in Tallahassee and what it means to you.
Tonight at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
Things get heated on the Hill.
I didn't vote to overturn an election, and I will not be lectured by people who did.
Plus, Pfizer looks at what a third dose might do, and a one-dose vaccine from Johnson & Johnson seems good to go.
To have them come in is nothing but good news.
I'm Jen White. It's the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And welcome back. Well, they're a local Black-owned business and a very tasty one, too. And this year, they are expanding from their popular food truck to a second brick-and-mortar location. For more, I spoke with Lakita Spann of Mr. Potato Spread. Take a listen. Hey, Lakita. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa. Happy to be here.
And it's nice to talk about some happy news. An expansion
Absolutely.
Of a local business. Your business, Mr. Potato Spread. I love the name of that. So you've expanded to a brick and mortar in addition to your popular food truck. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is actually our second brick and mortar.
Okay.
We have a food truck. We have our Regency Square Mall location. And most recently, we've opened up the Orange Square Mall brick and mortar as well.
All right. And in a time when so many businesses are struggling to stay afloat at all, you guys are on a roll. What's your secret?
I think, you know, when I have to think about everything that's going on in the world and the fact that, you know, we chose to expand in turbulent times, you know, a part of me makes me feel like I'm crazy. And then the other part of me is just really instincts and doing what I've always known to do. And that's really controlling what I can and focusing on the positive. And so, you know, I couldn't imagine having this burning desire to open a second location and allowing a pandemic or anything else, any other obstacle that might have presented itself from really stopping us from doing that. We were able to pivot, still make it happen. And so we saw no reason to continue to try to grow as we plan to do since we've been in business for the past 7 years.
Now, as I said, you started with a food truck and you've got a unique offering. These are baked potatoes topped with everything you can imagine. As I look at the menu at MrPotatoSpread.com, really creative recipes. What is it about this particular food you think that people have really started to embrace? These are gourmet baked potatoes and fries and potato salad. It's potatoes any way you like.
Potatoes any way you like. And that's why. When we thought about, you know, initially our goal was to start a food truck. And so thinking about ideas and what people would really gravitate to consistently, not just one time, not just because it was a fad. What we thought about in doing our research was we love potatoes and everyone around us loves potatoes. And people view potatoes very differently, right? And so we have customers that, you know, often say, I don't like baked potatoes, but I love French fries. Mm-hmm. Well, it's all the same to us. But customers really do look at potatoes and sweet potatoes, potato tots, you know, waffle fries. They look at all of those things very differently. And we just made a decision that, you know, we felt like potatoes were really underutilized. You could obviously get a baked potato, you know, with pulled pork or some sort of barbecue on it at some barbecue restaurants. But that was kind of where it ended, right? Or a loaded baked potato with cheese, chives, and bacon, sour cream. And so we really wanted to think outside of the box and really do some really cool things with all types of potato bases in order to appeal to almost any and everyone.
This is also a Black-owned business. And as we talk about this during Black History Month, tell us about you and your family's work to get Mr. Potato Spread to where it is today.
So Mr. Potato Spread began with myself and my husband. Also, when we started the business, we had three teenagers who are now adults. And it was important for my husband and I to create something that, you know, some sort of a legacy for our kids. I had been in corporate America. He had worked in fine dining for country clubs for years. And you know, that was great. And it worked for us to a certain extent. But it was even more important for us to just really see, right? I think this kind of started out as a, let's just see if we can do this, if we can make it happen. What we realized was we were really creating this really cool, great example for our kids to really be able to kind of not only join us in the struggle and the joys of everything that has occurred throughout the business, but also when I think about grandkids, that which we don't have yet, I think about, you know, the potential of the legacy that we could maybe be creating for our grandkids. And so that's really, just to kind of bring it all together, that's why this is really so important to us and our family and our kids. We're the first people in our family, at least our immediate family, to really be business owners, to be perfectly honest with you. And so at least that I'm aware of, and that's why I was specific about saying, you know, our immediate family. And so, you know, for some family members, they were very concerned about me leaving corporate America, my husband leaving his job, right? Because they had never seen it done before. And so that also, you know, adds a little bit of weight, you know, to what it was that we were trying to do. Now that we're in it, we see the value in making all of the sacrifices that we've made and setting the examples that we've made for us and for friends. And, you know, it's just, it's very, very important work that we're doing. And we see it as exactly that.
Well, congratulations on the hard work and the success of Mr. Potato Spread. Look for their food truck and their brick and mortar locations at the Regency Mall and now also the Orange Park Mall, a local and Black-owned business. Co-owner Lakita Span with us, and have fun. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a great day.
And just try wherever you can to support locally owned restaurants and locally owned businesses of all stripes. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. News director here at WJCT is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Make sure to join us today at noon, by the way, for the Florida Roundup, our live statewide call-in program where we round up the biggest stories across the Sunshine State each week. That's today at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. Have a great Friday, everyone, and a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.